Every time we talk about the modern workplace, it seems like we're talking about ways people should look to reduce their stress. It can be hard. Even if you can get in at 9 and out at 5, you may be juggling multiple projects and deadlines and have to get to meetings while all of that is looming. Not a recipe for calm. Our guest this hour urges people to take the time to be mindful. Mark Lesser is the author of 7 Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. Mark Lesser is the CEO at ZBA Associates, which provides leadership training, executive coaching, and keynote talks, all based on mindfulness. ZBA stands for Zen of Business Administration, which is also the title of one of his earlier books. Mark Lesser, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeffrey. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. So which came first, the mindfulness training or the business experience?
Actually, in my case, the mindfulness training. I was in my early 20s. I was, you know, minding my own business. I was an undergraduate at Rutgers and took a one-year leave of absence and came from New Jersey to the West Coast. And that 1 year turned into 10 years of living at the San Francisco Zen Center.
Were you the only person in MBA school who had Zen experience, at least that deep?
Yeah, probably. Although, you know, it was interesting that I found that there was a group of misfits. There were other, there were actors, and there were some medical people and others who were not trying to make a bundle of money on Wall Street, which at the time was a pretty popular ambition.
So what did send you to MBA school?
You know, what sent me was the 10 years that I spent living at the San Francisco Zen Center. I seem to always be given more and more increasing leadership responsibilities there. I spent a year running the Tassajara Kitchen. This is a Zen monastery in Central California that turns into a resort. And I was also, my 10th year, I was the director. And the aha that I had was that even though I saw myself as primarily a Zen student practicing, you know, practicing these contemplative practices, I also realized that I was running a business, you know, that especially as running the kitchen and as director, I was responsible for managing people, for solving problems, for budgets. And it looked to me like these two kind of separate activities, the practice of self-awareness, the practice of serving others, the practice of curiosity, and getting things done, they seemed like they went together really well. And I wondered, why isn't everybody doing this? This makes so much sense. And I decided that that's what I wanted to do with my work life, and felt that I clearly needed some business training, and went right from 10 years of Zen Center into the NYU MBA program.
Wow! So that explains the second half of the subtitle, Lessons from Google at a Zen Monastery Kitchen. So that's the kitchen where you got your experience, Tassajara. So then when you go into a different kind of world, it's not obviously, as you mentioned, it was a stressful kind of environment, or could have been. Are there people who just insist that the office environment is a very un-Zen place to begin with?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's always what I think of as that good, healthy tension between, you know, in the workplace, there is stuff that needs to get done. There are goals. It's the world of success and failure. And I think, you know, and partly why I felt it was time for me to explore life outside of the Zen Center was I wanted that kind of that kind of measurement and that kind of energy. But I also felt like there'd be some really effective ways of combining what looked like both of those worlds.
So this was not meant to be leaving Zen behind by any stretch.
Not at all. And in fact, I felt like it very much served as a real core base for the rest of my life. And it was, you know, oddly enough, it was my Zen training and meditation training, and which helped me get the call one day from some people at Google who said they were wanting to develop a mindfulness and emotional intelligence program inside of Google. Was I interested in helping to develop that? And And I ended up spending several years helping to develop a program at Google, and then created a nonprofit to bring this kind of mindfulness and mindful leadership into organizations around the world.
And that explains the Google part of the subtitle, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Condition. You start the book really with a quote from the management expert, Peter Drucker. I'm avoiding using the term management guru because everybody seems to use that. But he says, culture eats strategy for breakfast. How relevant is that to what you do?
Completely. You know, one of the things I'm fond of saying is that it's the dirty little secret of the business world is that it's all human beings. I think for much of the last 50 or 100 years, there was a sense that in order to be most effective in the workplace, you needed to get rid of the humanness. You needed to kind of treat people as though they were machines, as though they were little cogs in a wheel. I think of it as a kind of assembly line mentality. And I think more recently, there's an understanding that there's a need for humanness, there's a need for collaboration, and that this is one of the ways that will distinguish successful businesses. And I think this is what Drucker meant by, that culture will eat strategy for breakfast.
All right, so I'm not trying to pound all the square pegs into the round holes, but to take people for what they are, try to make them work into a cohesive group. That is one of the issues we'll deal with as we talk about 7 practices of a mindful leader, lessons from Google and a Zen monastery kitchen. Mark Lesser is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Mark and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about mindfulness at work. Mark Lesser is uniquely qualified to talk about this because he spent 10 years at a Zen center and then went and got his Master's of Business Administration. He's written a book called 7 Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. The monastery kitchen convinced him he should sharpen up his business experience, and then he put the program to work at Google. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come to square zero, Mark. How do you define mindfulness? How do you define mindfulness is where the emphasis should go.
One of the, I think that mindfulness is actually this, hugely kind of broad, deep topic, which on the one hand, a lot of what I like to do is make it easy and accessible for people. And on the other hand, I think there is something about the depth and broadness of it that I don't like to sacrifice. And in a way, I think I'd like to answer that question by kind of just throwing out these 7 practices that this book is about, which in some way was my way of trying to define what I mean by mindfulness. So I would say mindfulness is to love the work of self-awareness, to do the work, to have some kind of a practice, to not be an expert, to practice with a beginner's mind, to connect with your own pain, to connect with the pain of others, to depend on others, and to keep making it simpler. And in some way, I like both the kind of poetry and the pragmatism of these 7 practices as a way to at least to start the conversation about, well, what do we mean by mindfulness anyhow?
Let me go through this again. Love the work, do the work, don't be an expert, connect to your pain, connect to the pain of others, depend on others, and keep making it simpler. I want to take in a call here from Monty in Roseburg, who appears to want to ask something about mindfulness itself before we get too much farther from the conversation. Hi, Monty. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, Zen at its core, does it advocate the core of reality is contradictory, or put it another way, is Zen at its core irrational?
In what sense? Because you're asked to clear your mind, and yet you want to be mindful, that sort of thing.
No, I could give you an example, but I don't want to, you know, take up all your time, but I could give you an example of what I mean.
Let's see. You feel like you're ready to answer the question now, Mark?
Sure. I would say that, that you know, for me, Zen is really a buzzword for what does it mean to be a full human being? And also underneath that question, as you point to, is the question of, what is reality? What do we mean by reality? And I think it's paradoxical. And I think everything. It's funny. I don't know who it was. I tried Googling the other day. Who said if it's not paradoxical, it's not true? And what surprised me, it came up as Mark Lesser, that somehow I had said that. But and I have said that. But I was quoting something that I wasn't able to find. So I think there is something innately, ultimately contradictory and paradoxical about being a human being and about reality. So if that's what you mean, does Zen have that aspect to it? Yeah. And again, not to make it, what do I mean by that? I mean that, you know, on the one hand, there's a core practice of accepting what is, right? That I think a core practice of reality and of being a human being is the practice of acceptance. But on the other hand, we also need to work for change, you know, to solve real problems, to grow internally and externally. So, you know, accept what is and work for change is a kind of a core example of a paradox.
I want to give special thanks to Monty both for the call and for saying he didn't want to take up too much time. That was very polite of you, Monty. I appreciate that. We're talking to Mark Lesser about his book, Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, here on the Jefferson Exchange. It seems a lot of this is about intention, doing things because you mean to and not by rote.
Yeah, and I think and being more and more aware of the multiple layers there are of our own intention and our own motivations. I remember when I was a young man living at the Zen Center, I had one of my teachers was a Yurok trained shaman, and he used to say, you know, being a human being is really simple. You just need to ask and answer three questions. What do you want? What do you have to do to get it? And are you willing to pay the price? And he would then, you know, there'd be a loud belly laugh as he would then say, very few people bother asking the first question, what do you want? What do you want? Like what's really important to you? What matters to you? So these are, I think this is a core question, and noticing how complex that is and how complex our own motivations, our own feelings and emotions are, but more and more becoming more comfortable in our own skins.
Mark, you acknowledge the shoulders you stand on, including those of Daniel Goleman and his work on emotional intelligence. He listed five areas to cultivate. How did you develop your seven?
Yeah, my seven were, these actually came out of a time when I was training a group of Google engineers who wanted to be teaching mindfulness inside of Google. We were looking for how could we reach more people inside of this huge organization and spread these practices of mindfulness, emotional intelligence, and leadership. And I brought in a good friend of mine, a man named Norman Fisher, who is one of the world's leading poets and Zen teachers. And Norman kind of just extemporaneously came up with these seven practices, which were originally, these were core practices, core values for how to teach mindfulness at Google. And he just kind of rattled them off and talked about them. And when I heard Norman speak about these seven practices, I was just really struck by them. I was struck by how poetic and also how practical they were. And I noticed I started talking about them and writing about them. And little by little, a book began to emerge. And at some point, I kind of circled back, and I called my friend Norman and said, Norman, I'm feeling funny about this is turning into a book, this these seven practices that you spoke about. And Norman, of course, said to me, what seven practices? I don't know what you're talking about. He had totally forgotten about them, and I read them, what the seven practices were, and he said, oh, those are really good, and good luck with your book. So that's where they came from.
All right, so they are divided into three segments, we should point out: investigate, connect, and integrate. So in investigate, we come back to love the work. And does that refer to the work of achieving mindfulness or the work you're doing at work?
It can be both, but it's really meant to be the work of becoming more, cultivating self-awareness and helping others. I think this is the core practice. How can we become more and more self-aware? You know, and part of self-awareness, though, is also kind of going beyond ourselves, going beyond the limited ego. Again, a little bit of a paradox there, this studying the self, becoming aware of the self, and going beyond ourselves, but with the intention, with the ultimate intention of how can I serve? How can I really help others?
So love is drawn to work that is difficult. That's a really interesting phrase. What do you mean there?
I think being human is difficult. That just the fact that we know that at some point we will lose everything and everyone, that if we're lucky, we'll be subject to old age and sickness, that just the reality of not getting what we want and getting what we don't want, the reality that we're not in control. So just facing the difficulties and pain of being human, but also this is where the real joy and satisfaction in life is not pushing away the things that are difficult. So of course, it's no accident, I think, that that two of these seven practices are around, you know, connecting with your own pain, connecting with difficulty, and also having the courage to connect with the pain of others.
Those are definitely up there at number four and five. We're still back at number one, Love the Work, of the Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, a book by Mark Lesser, subtitled Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. He is a Zen master and has an MBA as well. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about mindfulness in daily life and in our work. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email from Jeff in Ashland, who writes, could Mark share the practical approach he took at Google, and does he feel that he had meaningful impact in light of some of the management issues that have come to light in the last couple of years? Thanks from Bax in Ashland.
Yeah, I felt like there was tremendous impact in Google in that literally, I think the numbers are maybe between 4,000-5,000 people have taken this mindfulness and emotional intelligence program that I helped develop that was called Search. It was a program called Search Inside Yourself. And I think it has had real impact, and Google has adopted this mindfulness practice as a core path toward well-being. You know, and Google, like any corporation, is complex and has many motivations, sometimes competing motivations. But I think that the trainings that I did and that I helped develop there have really helped people to feel more confident in themselves, maybe less stress, more able to listen to others is, I think, a core value, and the ability to collaborate more effectively.
Have you ever turned down Mark, I wonder, because the potential corporate clients looked like they were just trying to do this to further the bottom line and really weren't as interested in the people?
You know, I think as I was saying, I think there's many motivations for why people bring this work in, and I recognize that yes, sometimes people are, you know, they're a primary motivation might not be all that wholesome. But I find that usually underneath that motivation, even people who present that motivation that you're talking about of, you know, wanting to increase profits, that they get that underneath that it's about becoming more real, more vulnerable, more open is again paradoxically enough even the way to be a more successful company.
So when you're, and you do give some real exercises and practices in the book, I want to let listeners know about that. And I just want to come to really the nub of it all. I mean, the key to successful meditation or mindfulness practice.
Yeah, that's a question.
Yes. What are the keys?
Yeah. The key is to have the courage to show up fully. To connect with what your feelings are, what your thoughts are, to more and more be a fully aware, awake, joyful, sad human being, to really sink into your own your full experience. One of the expressions that I like that I think is a good way to think about mindfulness is to experience the experience that you're experiencing. So it's this to not push away,
to not be elsewhere, in other words,
to not be elsewhere, and to enter to really be curious about your full experience, including your feelings, your emotions, your thoughts, but over and over again to not be tossed around by ruminating about the past or worrying about the future, but to notice what is my life, what's happening with my life right now, what's happening right now.
And of the seven practices of a mindful leader, we're still on number one, love the work. We move on to do the work. Do you want to deliver the Carnegie Hall joke here?
Sure. I was actually just writing that joke. Yeah, it's a corny old joke. You know, that a person is wandering around Manhattan and goes up to a stranger and says, "How do I get to Carnegie Hall?" And the stranger on the street says, "Practice." and to me, you know, when people say, you know, how do I do mindfulness practice, or how do I cultivate these qualities of being a more awake, joyful, present human being, that's practice number two, which is the practice, do the work, to actually have a regular meditation practice. I kind of break the work into what I call a dedicated practice and integrated practice. So dedicated practice is having a daily practice where you can just stop, where you can just totally be with your breath and body. Nothing to do, nothing missing. This is an example of a dedicated practice. And then integrated practices. How do you bring that spirit of acceptance, curiosity, deep listening into your daily work life, your relationships, all parts of your life?
Let's take a quick call here before we go to a break. Mark in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Lesser, the author of Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader.
Good morning, Mark. I'm a person who's been practicing something akin to Zazen since 1984. It's called centering prayer. And one of the things I've noticed over the years is, as I've moved on and gone through various stages in my life, now that I'm getting towards the autumn of my years, I guess you could say, there's this innate sense of wanting to giggle a lot. There's laughter that sort of bubbles up. For instance, the Dalai Lama has this same sort of quality. I'm wondering if you have observed this over the years, that as we move towards the later stages of our lives and out of the workplace, there is this sort of sense of humor about everything we encounter.
Great question. Thanks for that, Mark.
Yeah, Mark. I often say that you know, these practices, in a way, ultimately, are, it's pretty humorous. You know, sometimes I walk into a, a Zen practice place and see people sitting and facing a wall, it's like, boy, you have to have a sense of humor about it all. And I think there is, I think ultimately there's something quite humorous about how seriously we take ourselves and the way that we interpret things. And I think when we get down below the surface, we, as you say, I think we tend to giggle a lot and see the unbelievable humor in everything.
It does get a little bigger as you get older, I notice, but yeah, keep laughing. The book is called Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. Mark Lesser is its author and our guest, and we'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Mark Lesser, who spent 10 years at a Zen center in San Francisco, but along the way ran the Tassajara Kitchen at a Zen center in California. So learned a little bit about managing a business facility and then went off to MBA school at NYU in New York. He has emerged with a whole new look at the world, both from Zen and his MBA experience. His book, his latest book, is called Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 as we talk about mindfulness and how to use it in the real world. 800-838-3760 and JX at jeffnet.org. Let's see, we did love the work, do the work. We're up to don't be an expert, three of the seven practices. In this area, you talk about embrace failure. I mean, many say so, but few people like failing. So how do you make it acceptable, even desirable?
Yeah, you know, none of us like failing. I don't like failing. But I have to say, when I, you know, and I think this is probably true for many people, when I look back at my life, at the, I was once fired from a company that I started, and I'm in really good, good company there. There've been some very, very prominent, successful people who've been fired from companies they started, and there's been, you know, so many small failures along the way. You know, so much of what I find in the business world, I ran a greeting card and calendar company for many years, and you know, and if I was lucky, 50% of the new products that we put out were successful, and 50% were failures, and so it was important to be able to try things and experiment and to learn from things that that didn't work.
Oh, that is a good sample there. You just put things out there and just see what works and what doesn't. Which this experience then goes directly into the next step, which is connect to your pain. Because isn't that the same, the company you were fired from that you were talking about? This is all, that was some of the pain too, wasn't it?
That was pretty painful.
Yeah,
that was one of the more painful moments of my life. And, you know, and there's been many, many painful moments of my life. And and there's something really potent about not pretending that pain isn't real, not pushing it away, and again, I think it has to do with this, you know, seeing part of it is seeing our common humanity, that are being able to connect with our own pain, and the following practice of connecting to the pain of others, paradoxically, is a hugely important practice within the workplace. Not that we want to turn, you know, workplaces into therapy sessions, but we also need to, and I think it's really important to connect with the common humanity that we share with the people working around us.
Which then gets us directly into connect to the pain of others, which Well, as you mentioned, you don't want to turn work into a therapy session. And then even when you are asking people things that you actually want the answer to, like, how are you? The answer is often fine. And I noticed you have a psychologist friend who suggested fine could be an acronym.
Yes, yes. Feelings inside not expressed, right? The beautiful, beautiful acronym. There's a couple stories that I talk about in the book. One is the story of being at a business conference of a group of very successful CEOs and social entrepreneurs, and in a group meeting where someone raises their hand and says they don't feel like they belong in this group, that they aren't as successful enough, or they're not doing enough in the world of social responsibility. And then another hand, and another hand, and there was this real amazing aha that the feeling of not belonging is a pretty common human experience. And it turned out that actually, where everyone could feel that sense of vulnerability, was a huge connector, and people were able to not only feel more connected, but were able to come up with better solutions in working together once they were more honest with each other.
So the kinds of pain that we're looking to share with each other, then, is this the sort of thing that is based around the workplace, though, rather than, geez, I got these things going on in my life out of here?
It could be, again, I think we can connect on different levels, but I think primarily, right, to be able to be honest about doubts that we might be having, to be able to talk about the pain of not meeting certain goals, or not rising in our organization as quickly or in the places where we want to, and be able to talk openly and vulnerably about the gaps between where we are and where we intend to be.
So once we've connected to the pain of others, then that slides right into the next of the seven practices, which is to depend on others, and particularly between leaders and followers. I'm curious to know, Mark, if this is a two-way relationship.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of the paradoxes, I think, around leadership, is that we think of leaders as people being in a particular role, and there are particular challenges and opportunities that people in that role have. But I think that clearly everyone is a leader, in the sense that leadership is primarily about influence. How can we influence others? And all of us, whether we're on a team in a company, or even if we have a one-person business, we are still very much influencing and being influenced by others.
And you point out how important collaboration has become in today's workplaces. And I have to wonder if this is often why companies bring you in, is just to get people to work a little better together.
I think totally. I think that, if you can have five really incredibly intelligent engineers, but if they're not working well together, if they're not collaborating and trusting each other, they're not going to produce good solutions. And I think this is the real aha in the business world, is how essential it is that people have high emotional intelligence in terms of working together, trusting each other. And there was this really fascinating study that Google did called Google Aristotle, in which Google really wanted to understand why certain teams were more effective than other teams, and they put a huge amount of resources and data collection, and they were surprised at that the answer had to do with how much people trusted each other, and the norms around making sure that everyone had equal amount of time in terms of speaking and listening.
So when you go into a company and you're trying to get teams of people to work together better, does it include things like meditating together? Are there joint mindfulness practices, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I find that, that for me, step number one is to get people to actually, take their game faces off and just be real human beings. And part of that is getting people to be quiet and just have a few minutes of just noticing what's happening how busy their minds are or aren't, having people check in with their with themselves, and then taking that and doing some listening practice, getting people to see what it's like to just listen to people that they work with without needing to have the right answers or needing to respond in any particular way. So just those two things are, I think, very practical and very potent.
That's a huge one. In fact, there was a part of us of the second practice, do the work, that I skipped the question on about coming back to listening. This is really about listening to other people. If people are not necessarily bad at it just because they are who they are, but they're bad at it because they're preoccupied, they have other things to do, how do they step outside? I mean, this is a big central part of this. Then how do they step outside their concerns about the projects looming, the deadlines above them, the meeting this afternoon, and just get to listening to the person who has a concern right now?
Yeah, I mean, this is the practice, I think, that you know, it just might save our world, that there's just not enough listening at all levels, whether it's you know, in the corporate world or in the political world, and it actually takes practice and takes courage to be able to not be so caught by our own concerns, our own thinking that we're right, our own interpretations of reality, and be able to open up to actually listen to another person takes practice.
It does. It does indeed. And let me go through the seven practices again, because we're about to hit the last one. Love the work. Do the work. Don't be an expert. Connect to your pain. Connect to the pain of others. Depend on others. And then finally, keep making it simpler. And oh, please tell us the story of the 84th problem.
I'm really impressed, Jeffrey, that you've read the book.
Yes.
And you're testing me on my knowledge of the book. That's great. Yeah, this is a... I don't actually know exactly where this story comes from, but it's apparently a pretty old story, having to do with a farmer who was living during the time of the historical Buddha, which was about 2,500 years ago, about 500 BC or so in India. And this farmer approaches the Buddha and says, I've got all these problems. Can you help me with these problems? You know, my crops are not doing well because of the weather, and my wife, you know, she's, you know, we're not getting along so well, and it's problematic. And my kids, they don't respect me. Can you help me? And the Buddha says, sorry, I can't help you. In fact, every human being has 83 problems. You know, that's just the way it is. And as soon as you solve one, there's another one that crops up. But the Buddha says, but maybe I can help you with the 84th problem. And the farmer asks, well, what is the 84th problem? And of course, the Buddha says, the 84th problem is wanting not to have problems. and I think the underlying, you know, lesson here is to shift our relationship with our problems, and to, you know, and of course, none of us want, we, you know, on some level, of course, we don't want to have problems. We all want to be problem-free, and we should want that, and we should want to solve problems. But there's something about also noticing what is, and imagine having an attitude of, bring it on, you know, bring on the problems, and having the confidence that we can enter them, we can meet the challenges, and we can be in a very healthy way look for solutions.
I'm struck by the discussion in this portion of the book that you're putting out the idea that nearly everything we do is a choice, and when you stop to think about it, it's really true. So I imagine that surprises a lot of people, though.
Yeah, I think it's really, seeing, you know, noticing, and this is part of meditation practice, I think, is noticing the thoughts and feelings that arise in us and how we choose where we put our attention and where we put our energy. This is like a, like, wow, like we actually can lean in and put more of our attention into solving problems, into finding solutions, into connecting with others, and less energy into self-criticism or wallowing in our you know, our own difficulties, judging ourselves, judging others. That these are choices.
As I look again at the three basic sections of the book in which you group the seven steps, it's investigate, connect, integrate. So the investigate is really going inward first, and then connect goes outward, and then you pull it all together in the end there. But the idea is to, it's kind of like the 12th step in 12 step programs, that you continue these actually through conscious contact and meditation.
Yep. I think there's the patterns here of right, the inward, the outward, and the integrate. It's like the 12 steps. It's also, I'm also really fond of leaning on people like Joseph Campbell and the Hero's Journey.
All kinds of great stuff. The book is called Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, Lessons from Google and a Zen Monastery Kitchen. It's the work of Mark Lesser, 10 years in a Zen center, and then he went to MBA school after that. Mark, thank you for joining us. Good to have you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I appreciate it a lot.